For 3 years, from 1689 to 1691, Ireland was a significant theatre in the early stages of a major European war. Multinational armies campaigned across the island, fighting pitched battles and besieging towns and cities. In Ireland, those 3 years are known by a variety of titles, as the Williamite War, the Jacobite War, the War of the Two Kings, and more recently, the War of the Three Kings. The forces involved were immense. In 1690, over 60,000 soldiers were present at the Battle of the Boyne, and a year later, perhaps 40,000 fought at the Battle of Aughrim. At the centre of those battles was the Irish Jacobite Army, a force comprised mostly of Catholic Irish soldiers. To learn more, I'm joined by author and historian Dr. Harman Murta, whose new book, The Irish Jacobite Army, contextualises the varied and remarkable stories of those soldiers and their generals. Harman, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you very much.
Before we discuss the Jacobite Army itself, can you explain to listeners why this European war was being fought in Ireland in the first place?
Well, the causes of the war are often misunderstood or not fully understood. On the one hand, it was an attempt to restore the Catholic King James, who'd been displaced in England. He was King of England, Scotland and Ireland, and the Irish chose to remain loyal to him. That was because he was a Catholic and the Irish Catholics expected much from him. But his throne had been seized in England by his son-in-law and nephew, William of Orange. And William of Orange's motive in doing so was because of his hostility to King Louis XIV, who was by far the dominant power in Europe at the time. So Ireland got dragged into that conflict, if you like. But the Irish had their own interest in it, in that the Irish Catholics had been losers for 100 years or so. They'd lost land, they'd lost wealth, they'd lost their power, they'd lost their influence, they'd lost government jobs, and they'd lost their church, so to speak, because the established church had taken over all the churches and the tithes, the tax that paid for them and so on. So they were hoping for a revival under James. And of course, when James was driven out of England, they therefore had a motive for seeing him returned. As the war wore, James came to Ireland and neither he nor the Irish got on very well with each other. And they were quite glad to see the end of him when he left after the Battle of the Boyne. And from then on, in the latter part of the war, really they were a much more nationalist force. And they bypassed James to appeal to Louis XIV to send a general to take charge of them in the final campaign, which he did.
But one of the huge surprises in all of this is that the Pope was on King Billy's side.
Yes, because Louis XIV was no friend of the Pope, and the Pope was no friend of Louis XIV. So while the Pope wasn't active in Ireland, he wasn't very enthusiastic as a supporter of James. It was said at the time that, you know, thanks was given in Rome, Te Deums were sung in Rome after the defeat at the Boyne. But that's not quite true. The Te Deums were sung in Vienna because the Emperor was William's ally against Louis XIV.
Now, in military terms, how was the conflict different, say, from previous foreign incursions? Say, for example, the Cromwellian invasion in the middle of the 17th century.
Well, the Irish had started off with much greater control of the country. They didn't control the north, but they controlled Dublin, the capital. And they also had an organised army and a single army, whereas the Confederacy had four different armies who didn't get on with each other. And also, the Confederacy was split between the Gaelic Irish and the descendants of the Normans, the Old English, as they were called. Common adversity had eroded a lot of those differences, not entirely, but had eroded a lot of those differences by the end of the 17th century. So you had a single army, a much more united force, and above all, you had a huge input of material, arms, and military experts from France.
And if somebody survived from the 1640s to the 1690s, would they have recognised the armaments? Would they have recognised the military formations? of the 1690s?
They largely would have, because these were common to the armies at the time. But the Jacobite army, I would say, was a more professional force than the armies previously. And the leadership was, on the whole, more professional, in the sense that there were returned Irish officers, but for the first 2 years of the war, there were 250 French officers in Ireland, providing the kind of support, if you like, perhaps a rough parallel with the Americans in Vietnam before the American forces got involved, yeah.
Now, those 3 years, the Williamite Jacobite Wars, were exceptionally violent for both soldiers and civilians, and for soldiers on both sides. Mm. Of course, the most famous, the infamous feature of the war, the most famous battle of the war is the Boyne of 1690. But the war was one of many battles and many sieges. Just give us a brief outline of the wider engagements of the war.
Well, the first thing that happened was the Jacobites controlled three quarters of Ireland, but they didn't control Ulster because of the penetration of Scots, especially into Ulster with the Ulster plantation. So they set out to do that. They managed to control East Ulster, but they failed to take Londonderry or Derry or Enniskillen in West Ulster. And then they were pushed out of Ulster and badly defeated at a battle, quite an important engagement at Newton Butler. So, if you like, the first year of the war was for Ulster, and the Jacobites lost it. King William came then himself in 1690 with reinforcements of every sort for his army in Ireland. And he fought the Battle of the Boyne, he captured Dublin, and he got control of Leinster, and he got control of East Munster. But he was held at Limerick. He wasn't able to take Limerick, thanks to Sarsfield's destruction of his siege train, and also because of the spirited defence that the Jacobites put up there. So that was the second year of the war, and that left the Jacobites in control of the west of Ireland behind the Shannon, and also of considerable area in Westminster. The third year of the war, a professional Dutch officer commanded the Williamite army, and he attacked the line of the Shannon and got into Connacht and Clare and forced the Jacobites to capitulate at the end of the war.
Oh, that was at the Battle of Aucrum.
That was, yes, after the Battle of Aucrum, yeah. Well, what happened was the French general Saint-Roux rather carelessly lost Athlone, and that allowed the Williamites into the west of Ireland. And the Jacobite army needed the west of Ireland to sustain the army, the countryside, to sustain the army. So Saint-Roux, while he wanted to get his own back for the loss of Athlone and, you know, have a victory, as well as that, if he was going to continue the war, he had to fight to get the Williamites out of Connacht. And he very nearly won the Battle of Aucrum. It's probable that the deciding factor was when a cannonball took off his head and his army was left kind of rudderless in the midst of a crisis moment. And the result was not its entire destruction, but very heavy casualties,
Was James II as inadequate a leader as traditionally depicted?
In Ireland, by and large, yes. But he did have his moments. He seems to have suffered from a sort of mental health problems, perhaps brought on by the stresses of what had occurred to him in England, where his daughters had deserted him and his army had deserted him, and there was general misery and mayhem. And he certainly took control of affairs here with the help of the French ambassador, who was very influential with him, and also Tyrconnell, who was the Irish leader. But he would have periods of doing very little, hunting and saying his prayers and so on. And then he had periods of activity. He was a trained soldier and sailor, and he had commanded the English Navy in battle. So he was no coward, no physical coward. But the Lord Clare, who was an O'Brien, one of the Irish, said after his performance in Ireland, he'd be better to forget trying to lead armies and spend the rest of his days saying his prayers in a monastery. So he wasn't a success in Ireland. And he did shore up the resistance in 1689, when the William had sent an army under Marshal Schomberg of about 10,000 men, and they marched down from Ulster and they got bogged down at Dundalk, and James marched up and he stood his ground there, and that was maybe his finest moment in Ireland. But he saw Ireland as a stepping stone to get back to England, and when he saw that wasn't going to happen, he lost interest really in being in Ireland. And I think by 1690, he was just going through the motions, you know.
Now, the Jacobite army wasn't the only Catholic fighting force in the country at that time. Operating across front lines were a group known as the Rapparees.
Yes.
They were kind of a partisan force. Tell me what they did.
Well, they were part exactly that. Well, what happened was, after the Battle of the Boyne, King William said, if any Irish ordinary folk that go back to their homes, they'll be left in peace. And he probably intended that. But his army didn't do that. As they came down into Leinster, and especially as they crossed Leinster to attack Athlone in first time in 1690, the Ulster regiments in particular ignored that and abused the country people to the extent that they turned the country people into rebels. And these guerrillas, partisans, they called them Rapparees at the time, they were a very heavy burden on the Williamites. They massacred stragglers, they stole horses, they interfered with communications, and generally you can know from the language used about them by the Williamites and the efforts made to control them that they were a considerable force. And the Irish army, now west of the Shannon, realised this, and they sent officers and non-commissioned officers across to, you know, take control and provide leadership, military leadership for the Rapparees. But if the Rapparees were caught, they were strung up. That was it. But the Irish officers and NCOs that came, they came with a certificate from their commanding officer saying, I'm an officer in the Irish army. And they generally survived the experience, yeah.
Now, Irish officers towards the end of the war are in more prominent positions. And the most famous of them all, obviously, you've already mentioned him, is Patrick Sarsfield.
Yeah.
A legendary figure. Do the facts match the legend?
To an extent, they do. He had soldiered on the continent and then he soldiered in England in the Horse Guards. And he was the equivalent of a lieutenant colonel in the Horse Guards. And he was one of the few soldiers that opposed William in England. Then he comes to Ireland and he's given command of a cavalry regiment. And he's an important, but not a terribly important person in 1689. In 1690, after the Battle of the Boyne, there's a sort of revolt among the Irish officers, the leading Irish officers, led by Sarsfield, in which they're insisting that they take control of events, and they send a deputation to France looking for a French general and so on. And he had a great success when he led a cavalry raid against the Williamite siege train at Ballyneety, and that really thwarted the Williamite attempt to capture Limerick, because William was left without sufficient powder, especially to have a prolonged siege, make a big enough breach in the wall. And when he attacked it, he was driven back. And that Ballyneety raid got, you know, European headlines. So good for Sarsfield's reputation. But after that, when William was gone, Kinkle, the commander he left in Ireland, did a strange thing. He made a midwinter attack on the Shannon, all along and on Kerry, in various places. And so it was Sarsfield that organised the defence, the successful defence of the West against that attack. So that was very much to his credit. When Samroo came, he begins to drop. You know, you don't hear much about him. But after Samroo's death, he's the leading Irish soldier. And even though there are French generals still left who outrank him, nonetheless, he's really calling the shots. And the Williamites, you know, constantly worrying and fussing about what Sarsfield going to do and so on, they obviously rated him very highly. But after he went to France, he was killed in France after a couple of years. He served under Marshal Luxembourg, one of the greatest soldiers in Europe at the time. And Marshal Luxembourg said this about him. He said, told Louis XIV that he had particularly noticed the valour and fearlessness of which Sarsfield has given proof in Ireland. I can assure your Majesty he is a very good and a very able officer. That's quoting Luxembourg. Coming from such a distinguished soldier, that's praise indeed.
Now, Aucrim, the Battle of Aucrim, I suppose the deciding moment of the war. Is it the battle with the most fatalities of any battle fought in Ireland?
It probably is, yeah. The Williamites lost about 2,000. They claimed, many Williamites claimed this, or several of them anyway, that the Jacobites lost as many as 7,000. One Jacobite account says we lost 2,000 casualties, now not counting prisoners, and King James's memoirs, which were written in France, but by a team that probably included people who'd served in the war in Ireland, they admit to 4,000 casualties killed. So that's about between the 2 and the 7. It could be around that. It might be right. It's hard to say, you know.
Obviously, it was a disaster also for thousands of camp followers. This is something you also cover in the book, who accompanied the army. Who were the camp followers?
Well, these are the wives and children of the soldiers. They moved around with the army and had to be fed and accommodated to some extent as well. The only time they became involved in combat was during the Siege of Limerick, when they hurled broken bottles at the advancing Williamite soldiers. At Aucrim, a Danish soldier who wrote an account mentions that when the Jacobite army was broken and fleeing and the dead were all over the place, and he says he never saw so much blood in his life and so on, he said the lanes were filled with wailing women. And when, and this is an extraordinary statement, but when the Irish soldiers went to France after the war, the French officials in the ports that were receiving the Irish soldiers said, they've come with wives and children, they said, and the officers have maybe 10 and 11 children with them, and the soldiers 5 or 6. Well, if that's true, presumably the same number were tramping around after the army in Ireland.
After Aucrim, the Jacobites flee to Limerick. How did they manage to avoid annihilation and manage to effectively leave Ireland, the Jacobite army or the remnants of the Jacobite army, intact?
Well, Limerick is an extraordinarily difficult place to besiege because the River Shannon runs down, and the core of Limerick is called the English Town in those days, was built on an island, and two branches of the Shannon go around the island. And to cross the Shannon was difficult. So William only besieged it from the east side, from the County Limerick side. Hinkel started doing that in 1691. And he did manage eventually to cross over to the west side with some, or get some forces over to the west side. But Hinkel was Dutch, and he wanted to see the war in Ireland ended no matter what, because he wanted the Williamite army to move to Flanders, where it could, you know, fight on behalf of the Dutch. So he was anxious to end the war. Meanwhile, in Limerick, Sarsfield is waiting for a promise of further assistance from France in the form of food and military supplies. And there's no sign of these to arrive, and the food is running out, and they've worked out that it'll have run out by in 3 weeks' time or a month's time. So finally Sarsfield says, or agrees, that we must bargain now while we've something left to bargain with, because if we've no food left, we just have to surrender. An army can't fight with no food. So therefore he enters into negotiations, and he has, Ginkel's anxious to end the war, Sarsfield is still in control of Limerick, so there is something to negotiate with. And the Sarsfield at this stage is thinking of moving to France. And so the arrangement is, if the Irish soldiers want to go home, they go home and live in peace. If the Irish landowners, who are still in resistance in the army or under its protection, if they want to go home, they can go back to their estates, and they'll be allowed to keep them. If the Irish soldiers want to go to France, Ginkel will provide the transport, the shipping to get them there. to end the war. So that was the deal.
Pretty good deal.
A pretty good deal. So it seemed. It wasn't that well drafted for the civilians. And, you know, the result was the penal laws. And certainly you could say it was dishonoured in the spirit. It's rather more difficult to pinpoint it being dishonoured in the letter, but it is, to some extent, that is true. However, 5,000 soldiers had gone to France already in 1690. And now another 15,000 or so went with Sarsfield. So there were about 20,000 Irish soldiers in France.
And these are the famous wild geese.
These are the wild geese, yeah. Mm.
Now, the book has extraordinary detail within its pages, but it also has a long history of its own, and one that starts with your co-author, your father.
My co-author, yes. My father had served in the LDF during the war, and he's very interested in military history. And he's one of the founders of the Military History Society of Ireland. So he started writing his PhD on the Jacobite Army. And sadly, he died before his time, before it was complete. And I was only a little boy of 11 then. But I was already inculcated into the Jacobite Army. And so it was an ambition of mine to finish it for him. And I read history in Trinity with Dr. Sims, as both as an undergraduate and postgraduate. And of course, he was a great expert in Jacobite Ireland, Gerald Sims. And so I finished the book eventually.
A labour of love, and we're very grateful for it indeed. Dr. Hammond Murta, many thanks for joining us on the History Show this evening to talk about the Irish Jacobite Army, published by Four Courts Press.
Thank you very much.